the radio show where we talk about science, we have fun with science, and we play some really cool records.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is iScience Radio, your weekly dose of interesting topics and news in science coming from Imperial College Radio. I'm Bernadetta Dodonaide. I'm sitting in for Hillary today. And on the show, we have today prepared you a whole host of stories about bad science. What is bad science? Can scientists be bad? Is placebo effect just a bad science? All of this and more coming up to you shortly.
This is iScience Radio
News.
Hi everyone, I'm Madeline, news editor here at iScience, and this week I'm here with Danny and Gina from the news team to give you a weekly science roundup. First up, nutritionists in the UK have launched a new portion size guide to tackle overeating and obesity. The British Nutrition Foundation's guide is designed to complement the government advice on the sorts of food to eat, spelling out just how much of each sort of food constitutes a healthy diet for both men and women. For example, 2 handfuls of pasta, a bunch of spaghetti the thickness of a £1 coin, 2 thumbs of cheese, and a fistful of broccoli constitutes a healthy dinner.
Next, scientists claim to have captured the first ever images of 2 black holes, including Sagittarius A star, the black hole at the centre of our galaxy. So far, black holes have been impossible to observe because they are so compact that a telescope the size of Earth is needed to see one. This problem was solved by creating a virtual telescope which links telescopes from all over the Earth. Scientists hope that the iconic images captured will be released later this year.
Finally, a new AI-powered smartphone app has proven it can identify rare genetic disorders more effectively than clinicians. Currently, these conditions are difficult to diagnose because clinicians don't see them that often. Called Face to Gene, the app's algorithm has learnt the signs of genetic disorders from over 17,000 images of faces. But despite Face to Gene's success, it still has a long way to go to being 100% accurate, especially when diagnosing people from non-Caucasian ethnic backgrounds. The developers are now working towards improving this and hope it will become a quicker, easier way of diagnosing rare genetic diseases.
And that's all we've got time for here. Tune in next week for more science news.
And we're back in the studio. And in the studio today with me, I have Danny, I have Jacqueline, I have Harry, and I have Aaron to talk all about bad science. But first I want to ask, do any of you really measure your food with handfuls and thumbs? And no? I just don't measure my pasta with handfuls. I don't know. I just find that strange.
I once read a thing on Facebook or something that, you know, you're like kind of metal pasta spoon that you use to stir pasta.
Yeah, yeah.
The like hole at the end is apparently the perfect pasta portion.
At the end?
Yeah, there's like a hole at the end of the metal spoons. And if you like measure your pasta by that much, apparently it's...
But is that like, the purpose of it?
I'm not sure. I thought it was just for hanging on a hook.
And also, yeah, everyone has different portion sizes. Even like the same person will have a different portion size. That's true. It's
different hand sizes as well. So, I mean, yeah, okay. I mean, pasta and portion sizes is not the topic that we're talking about today. Today, we're talking all about bad science. And if you want to give us any comments or any ideas, please contact us at icradio.com/contact. So, bad science. What is bad science? And perhaps you wonder, why did we pick this topic? Well, we picked this topic because the next edition of iScience magazine will be all about bad science. And therefore, in the studio today with me, we have Jacqueline, who's one of the editors of the iScience magazine. So, Jacqueline, why have you chosen this topic?
It was kind of an amalgamation of ideas in coming up for something that answered a lot of questions. The first one being, what would engage our readership? What would engage our writers? And secondly, what is something that I felt is not often talked about? I think I find that in most things I like to engage in, it's normally things that my mum will have a go at me for being interested in. But it started with just reading up on eugenics and some of the history of the 20th century science.
Stuff, huh?
Yeah, exactly, I like the tough stuff. So. Kind of from that I thought, oh well, I would like to write about this. I think this is something that would be interested, but it's not the only problem in science. It's not one of the only examples when it comes to the issues in 20th century science. So bad science kind of stemmed with that. I thought about it for a couple of weeks and what could sum up everything that this issue could possibly be about in bad science. What came to mind?
Yeah, so as you said, bad science is such a broad topic. So everyone in the studio now, what does actually bad science mean to you? What first thing is that comes up to your head when you think about it?
I mean, I would definitely say science with an agenda, especially if that is a politically motivated agenda, could very much be construed as bad, because from my opinion, science should be about the advancement of knowledge. And if there is some sort of bias, even if it's an unconscious one, that's going to impact your results, that's going to affect things, and that is bad.
Anyone else?
I think perception of bad science is quite important. So I was reading about back in 2007 when the Large Hadron Collider at CERN was being turned on, and there was lots of scare stories about how it would create black holes which could end up consuming the Earth and wiping out humanity. And it, you laugh at this, but it featured in some very prominent sort of legacy media outlets in the UK, and it all happened from one interview with a scientist, and I think he made a joke, and suddenly there's genuine scaremongering. Actually, the scale of how worried people were is that CERN was taken to court, fairly sure, over this in an attempt to stop them from conducting the experiment. And it got taken to court, and the judge was like, being ridiculous, and then the case ended. But
I think probably a big problem is that bad science attracts big headlines, and it sort of spreads more easily
to make it newsworthy
than good science, right?
It's fantastical, and everyone loves a good story.
Yeah,
regardless if it's good or bad.
Yeah. Yes. So for me, I'd say there's kind of two broad areas of bad science. There's the bad communication of science, which is the scare stories and the kind of disproportionate when there's a miraculous cure for something. So there's bad communication, and then also there's bad scientific practice. So thing like Andrew Wakefield and the MMR. So that was a bit of both. There was bad scientific practice going on, and then there was scaremongering in the media.
And the consequence of it are huge. Mm-hmm.
And still being felt today. So.
Yeah. To me as a researcher, I think bad science means, firstly, I think about misconduct, scientific misconduct, and sort of I'm trying to think about more broadly of what leads people to commit scientific misconduct. Why would a researcher fake results? Why would you need that?
I think there's so much pressure, isn't there, in terms of to get funding, to get publicity, to get publications out there, that I guess it can convince some researchers, some scientists, to alter their results to make it look more likely, to support their arguments more, so in order to get funding to continue what they're doing. And I think that arises from the circumstances being too competitive.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps there not being enough funding in science.
I guess you've also got things like, was it Millikan's oil drop experiment, when he was finding out the charge on an electron, and people go back over his results. And you look through this book, and he's just scribbled out, he's cut out lots of his own results that returned an incorrect answer. These are things that he measured, but it didn't fit with what he wanted it to be, so he kind of redacted it in his notebook.
So I think we're gonna come back to these redacted results, not full results, right, later on in the show. And in addition, I think another thing that at least people from scientific background for sure think of as a bad science would be things that we call pseudoscience, things like homeopathy, for example. Mm-hmm. Do any of you know any history of how did homeopathy came to be?
Yes, I do actually. Let me go to the chapter on homeopathy in my book here.
She has a secret book that has all the answers to the questions in the world that you might have.
So, homeopathy, I don't know if I can pronounce this correctly, Hahnemann, who I believe was, I'm guessing, German, but I'm not sure.
Yes, he was a German doctor
in the late 18th century. So at the time, obviously, mainstream medicine was pretty medieval still back then. Things like bloodletting with leeches. They didn't really have evidence-based medicine yet. But Hahnemann decided that homeopathy would work by treating people with the thing that made them ill in the first place.
I think it's called like heals like, or something like that.
It's just like a vaccine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, in a way, yes, because the idea is that you give it to them in a diluted form, and the more dilute the form, the more powerful it is at reversing the symptoms that substance usually causes.
Uh-huh.
But the issue with homeopathy, of course, is that they dilute it to such serial dilutions. Well, I mean, there's many issues with homeopathy, but one of the main ones is the actual, when you actually look at how they dilute the substances, by the time they reach their final concoction, there is physically no more of that molecule left. It's just water.
So I think if I'm right, in that book he talks about, there was one case where he had like a glass of water, a glass of something, and then he halves it and halves it again and halves it, diluting it every time, and he halves it 40 times. At that point, like, statistically, of having even one molecule of the original substance is such an infinitesimally small number that he did it by urinating it, and he was happy to drink it after it had been diluted 40 times.
So yeah. When you explain this to people, like the history of how homeopathy came to be, why do you think people still believe it?
So, I mean, it's interesting. So the main idea, because homeopathy works, and everyone's going to be outraged right now, but in a sense, homeopathy works. Now, I'm not saying it's the water or the sugar pill or anything like that. Instead, it's a rather curious phenomena known as the placebo effect.
Okay, placebo, you say. We're going to come back to a placebo in a bit. But before, let's just have a little bit of music to calm us down with all these controversies about placebos and homeopathies. Oh, goodness me. So let's listen to Lana Del Rey, Blue Jeans.
Rushed to death and sick as cancer. You said punk rock, I grew up on hip hop. You fit me better than my favorite sweater. And I know that love is mean and love hurts. But I still remember that day we met in December. Oh baby, I will love you till the end of time. I will wait a million years. Promise you'll remember.
are back talking all about bad science. And at least in UK, I think perhaps one of the most famous books written about bad science and accidentally called bad science was by British doctor Dr. Ben Goldacre. He's a doctor and epidemiologist in University of Oxford. And so Danny has been reading and looking into that book and this whole movement that has been started by Ben Goldacre about bad science. So what is Ben Goldacre talking about?
So yeah, so this is the mystery book that I was reading. So Ben Goldacre actually covers a huge variety of different topics within the book. One is sort of like the kind of quacks that you get in terms of scientific sounding products that are marketed towards the consumers. So these are things like moisturizing cream or like detox treatments or like nutritionist recommending.
Are you saying that not all creams make my skin glow?
So all creams moisturize, and there's no denying that, but all the kind of super sciencey sounding chemicals that they say in the cream don't really have any effect any more than just general Vaseline would.
I think I watched not that long ago Horizon, I think, documentary about hair, and they were testing, like, you know, in shampoos they often have, oh, this shampoo contains tryptophan, and I was thinking, how does putting an amino acid on top of my hair make any difference?
Yeah,
like,
that was
it just
exactly.
Where's the logic?
That was
there?
Another example that was used in these moisturizing creams, so that you have these chains of amino acids in the moisturizing cream, and when they dry on your face, you get that kind of, and for any people out there who use moisturizing cream, your face feels kind of tight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of the amino acid chains kind of contracting on your skin. And they'll say things like, this particular amino acid is used in collagen formation. But they'll be very careful. They won't say that that specific amino acid will help your skin.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say it's beneficial for collagen formation, which is true of all the amino acids that are used to make collagen. And then they'll say overall the cream moisturizes your skin, because it does, just like Vaseline does.
Yeah.
But they'll never put the two together, because that would be false advertising, but they'll get to you in other ways.
Mm. Mm.
So that's like the first sort of topic that he talks about. Then he moves on to like homeopathy and the placebo effect.
So can you explain what is the placebo effect?
So the placebo, I mean, no one really knows how it works, and it's so much more interesting than trying to understand why, you know, so like people like homeopathy works because of the dilutions and like strange chemical energies and residues left over, and the water has memory of the particles. That's all just...
It doesn't? There's no brain in the
water? Pretty bollocks, to be honest, if you'll excuse my language. Whereas the placebo effect is a cultural effect. So it depends on your culture as well.
Oh.
And it's basically just about your experience with being treated. And even that will impact you, in terms of a doctor could act really confident and be like, this is a new treatment, it's just come out, it has a really high success rate, we're going to try you on it and you should expect to feel better in 2 weeks.
So do you,
and then
so
that
I
person will feel better in
yeah.
2 weeks, even if they haven't actually had this miraculous
yeah.
drug.
So are you saying that, so homeopathy works because of placebo effect?
Yes, exactly.
But then, so maybe it's, I mean, if it doesn't do you any bad, maybe, and it does do you good, even though it does good not through the compounds that are used, but just through probably social interaction and, you know, the actions that you take to drink that homeopathy pill. So maybe we should keep it. I mean, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, so I mean, like a lot of the things, Ben Goldacre does sort of like state that when you look at things, a lot of these sort of like sham treatments can be beneficial in a way. It involves going to someone and talking about your issue, or it involves, you know, doing a detox program, which might involve you eating healthy foods. Like, this is all good in itself. The issue is that homeopathy stating that it's based in science and that it pits itself against mainstream medicine,
mm-hmm.
In such a kind of vitriolic way, is what's really damaging. When you start getting situations where people will go to a homeopathic treatment over a mainstream medical treatment, in cases such as, you know, cancer or something like that, where, you know, people can end up
yeah.
Dying because they haven't you know, they've gone for a treatment because they believe that will work, but there's only so the placebo effect can only go so far. It can help with colds. It can't really cure cancer.
Yeah.
So, well, one of the really interesting things that I found out when looking into the placebo effect is not only does the colour of the pill affect how well it affect what it does to you, and that can be anything from certain colours of pill are more effective to kind of treat, as it were, certain conditions.
So it's like Matrix, blue and red pill.
Yeah, so I think blue is better as a painkiller than other colours of pill.
Oh, wow.
And yellow and red and orange pills are used for making people more like alert, that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so not only that, but it continues to work even if you know it's a placebo.
Oh, well, that's strange.
That's not 100% that's of the time. Uh-huh. But the very like act of taking a pill and going through those actions for the majority of people up until the point in their life when suddenly it doesn't work, if you've ever been to the doctor, you've been prescribed pills, you've taken them, you've got better. So your body goes, oh, I've taken a pill. That must be helping me. Mm. And so it does. So people can go and they can get prescribed sugar pills and get told they're sugar pills and it will still sometimes help them.
Yeah, so one of the ideas behind this is that your body forms associations with specific, in the same way as like when you look at Pavlov's dog, which, you know, used to salivate in response to the bell.
Yeah.
Humans can associate getting better with taking pills or having an injection. So they actually did one experiment where they looked at immune suppression, where they gave human patients and also animal patients for that matter a drug that suppresses the immune system at the same time as giving them a particularly distinctive flavor drink. And after an amount of time, they could just administer the drink and it suppressed the immune system in both animals and humans. So this tells us that just even performing simple actions that have no kind of pharmacological actual like action inside your body can make your body do things. It can make your brain do things.
It almost makes you, it sort of makes you think that, oh, you know, our bodies are more powerful than we think.
Mind
but
then matter.
This, yeah, but then this is also what often, you know, all these hoax sciences trying to portray that, you know,
exactly.
You do this and your body, it's all about the body. Yeah, Aaron.
I think it's worth pointing out that not all homeopathy is pills. And placebo can't just be pills. It's worth noting acupuncture as well is kind of homeopathy, which lots of people actually think work, but it is completely debunked.
So it's another example of alternative medicine.
And
the
problem is there can be negative consequences of having acupuncture as well. There's like history of people having parts of their back damaged or their neck damaged, or current problems exacerbated, made worse because of acupuncture.
And chiropractor.
Yeah. And actually, if you think about sort of alternative medicine, traditional medicine, if you go to certain cultures where they might use from endangered species, like there's the whole thing about using tiger bones, isn't there? Like ground tiger bones. Well, okay, it might very well make people better because of the placebo effect, but at the same time, having to kill endangered species in order to do so isn't great either. So there can be other consequences that way.
As I said, there was a fascinating documentary on, I think it was on the BBC, several weeks ago, if not a couple of months now, actually, which looked into the placebo effect as a treatment for back pain.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things they discovered as part of the experiment they did was that just the time that a GP spends in the consultation with you dramatically affects the rate of success of a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So people who were cut off after 10 minutes in their appointment, which is basically middle of the sentence, and the GP said, I'm really sorry, I've got other patients to see, we'll finish this another time, got better far less than the people who were allowed to talk for 20 minutes and half an hour and basically get all of their frustrations about treatments not working out.
Mm. I think they found something similar in terms of if you keep seeing the same nurse or doctor as well, you're much more likely to get better than if you constantly switch between doctors. I think it just comes back to that building
trust.
Up trust, isn't it?
Exactly.
Interaction
and that's why
people
why people go to homeopathic treatment, because it's all about selling.
And familiarity.
Familiarity and trust, and they'll sit there and they'll listen to you, and then they'll give you a definite diagnosis and a definite treatment schedule.
Mm.
And that in itself is powerful enough to help people get better. So as far as they're concerned, they go see a homeopathic doctor, they take the pills, and they feel better, and they don't care about why it works or how it works.
I find it interesting that, like, on NHS website, when I type in homeopathy,
yeah.
you go on NHS website, and they clearly state that homeopathy doesn't work, but it doesn't hurt.
Yes.
It's kind of, you know, it doesn't do any bad, so let's leave it. Another thing that sort of we touched beforehand, but we haven't actually gone into, is something about not reporting all the results. So I think Ben Goldig mm-hmm. has written a second
yes.
book, which is called Bad Pharma, and probably he mentions this in the first book as well, about the fact that, especially with clinical trials, there's often the case that so many clinical trials are conducted, but only the ones with a positive outcome are reported. And so the doctors don't get every single piece of information to be able to rightly to decide whether a drug is effective or not, and this is a really big problem.
I'd say there's only one situation I can think of which actually is almost like the classic exception that makes the rule, is that when the situation in the drugs trial is so bad that it then gets reported because it's so dangerous what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Which happened probably about 10 years ago when there was a drugs trial and it was a double blind. So the doctors who were administrating the drugs did not know which two out of the eight were placebo and which six were the actual drug. But the people who who were in the trial, all six of those who were injected with the actual drug ended up in intensive care for 3 weeks. They were all having total systemic failure. They all survived, luckily, but obviously their lives have been impacted incredibly heavily by this, and it was so serious that it was reported. It's changed the way that drugs trials have been run ever since because it was such a bad situation.
Yeah, I've recently read, there was recently a study looking at 105 different clinical trials for antidepressants, which all were approved by the FDA, but only I think 48% of those trials had actually a positive outcome, but most of those the positive outcomes were always reported, and the rest of the trials were never even mentioned. And so it's no surprise that so many people are on the drugs, which are ineffective, but they're just sort of desperate to get just the treatment of sorts.
I think one thing that came to mind that I've done some reading and writing into was the process of the US and the FDA approving their first female Viagra pill.
Mm.
And it was a very hotly contested issue, and you can read into it. There's a lot of issues I think many people took with the whole process. But one of the issues in terms of the conduct of the clinical trials was initially the drug was meant to treat hyposexual disorder in females. So females obviously lack a sexual drive, whereas male Viagra pill doesn't treat sexual drive, it treats erectile dysfunction. Those
mm-hmm.
are two very different, one is very physiological, one is quite chemical and hormone based, and female sexuality is mechanically very different to men. In the trial for the FDA, they were evaluating the effect of alcohol with patients. During the trial, 23 out of 25 of the patients on the trial were men. The pill is designed for women, it's marketed to women and sold to women. Any physiological analysis into alcohol.
Isn't it?
Exactly. The pill was approved 18-6 by the FDA in 2015, despite a lot of critics saying that the clinical trial didn't actually present any significant benefits. It didn't outweigh the risks, and yet it's a drug that is sold widely across the US.
Yeah. Just another example of really a bad conduct. Great, so speaking of Viagra and probably love, let's get on to our next song, which is Rita Ora, Let You Love Me.
stay with you last night. Instead of going out to find trouble, that's just trouble. I think I run away sometimes. Whenever I get too vulnerable, that's not your fault. See, I wanna stay the whole night. Gets too real, and every time I feel I'm sabotaging, I start running. Yeah. And every time I push away, I really wanna say that I'm sorry, but I say nothing. I wanna stay the whole night.
Great, and during the break, we here in the studio had some really interesting discussions about both placebo and maybe things that should not be mentioned. yes. So, even though people usually think about bad science as, well, as we said, homeopathy or maybe scientific misconduct, science, if one thing that we, at least our group here, has been taught in the last term by our lecturer, Stephen, is that science is really not only a big bag of facts, but it's really a social construct, and science is done by people. And sometimes it definitely is the case that science can be done, a good science can be done by bad people. And I think perhaps people have seen lately in the news a lot of talk on this topic, and Aaron will tell us a bit more about it.
Yes. So I wanted to talk about Watson, as many people might have heard of him from Watson and Crick, discovery of DNA. He's been in the news lately, so he co-discovered DNA with Crick in the 1950s. He's already been a controversial figure due to receiving all the credit alongside Watson for the discovery of DNA, even though it was based off of the work of Rosalind Franklin, a British chemist. Anyway, leaving that aside, he won the Nobel Prize in 1962. But he's just had his honorary titles stripped from him due to comments of his claiming that genes cause a difference in intelligence between black and white people in IQ tests. He had been previously relieved of administrative duties due to remarks similar in nature. And his comments were very much unfounded given that lots of other scientists came out with evidence against that. He didn't have any research to back up his claims. And so I wanted to go through a few of the things he's previously been heard saying. So he said that he was inherently gloomy about the prospect of Africa because of all of our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really. He also said that women should be allowed to abort a child for any reason, such as if a gene for homosexuality was found in the fetus. And when talking about, he said that he hoped everyone was equal, but people who have to do with black employees find this not to be true.
So I find it so disappointing that, you know, I do understand that, like, science is done by people, so you have all sorts of different scientists, but Watson is one of those household names, right? It's one of, people often don't know who done a discovery, but Watson and Crick, it's so iconic. It's so disappointing that one of these people has to be this.
It makes the public distrust science even more, because you think, well, if he's so wrong about all this stuff that he's clearly wrong about, how, like, was he ever right? Like, you know, when very public scientific figures have such a fall from grace, it doesn't just tarnish their name, it tarnishes the name of science.
I find it interesting that just the great contrast between, so his discovering of DNA led on to being able to help cure genetic diseases and has such a long-lasting impact on medicine and biology, such a positive impact, and now he's made all these comments through the years. Do we think that he should have been stripped of his honorary titles? Do we think that the science that he conducted nearly 70 years ago should be kept separate from his public comments and his opinions? Or do you think that as a representative of science that he should be more careful and should be held to account for his opinions?
I do think he should. I mean, I don't think that you're, no matter how significant the achievement is, and we can't really even tell how significant it is. I mean, it's a discovery of DNA, it's the core of life. It doesn't entitle you to these sorts of things, right?
I think, yeah, one thing that is often overlooked when discussing is not obviously weighing his contributions to science against his views on race, gender, or sexuality. I think one thing is also acknowledging is the alienation of these parts of the population when they hear these comments from someone who's revered. It's not just that, you know, is their scientific discovery still, you know, worthy of the praise that we give it? That can be separated. But one thing is worth acknowledging that if you are a young girl who learns about Watson and Crick in school and Rosalind Franklin, and then you hear that the person who said this believes this about your gender, you may not want to go into that field of science. And I think one thing that we're all hoping is that the field does get more diverse and we're more accepting. So, you know, I agree with you that should hold it accountable.
I mean, I would say exactly the same thing, especially because that seems to me like some very deep set long-term prejudice. But the idea of, you know, saying, for example, women should be able to abort a fetus because they've discovered that there's a gene for homosexuality, I mean, that sounds to me very much like eugenics and ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, and the horrible thing is, so these this whole thing resurfaced because recently there was a documentary on Watson. It's called Decoding Watson. It's, I think, 2 weeks ago was done by PBS. Really good one. I've watched it. I suggest everyone watching it. And I did not know this. So Watson is now, he's in Cold Spring Harbor, which is a very famous institution in biological sciences. They do a lot of cancer research. But it has a history of eugenics, so beforehand. So, I mean, this is a sort of, I don't know if it's right to say it this way, but it's kind of a PR thing for the administration to strip him off of all of these things because they just don't want to be associated with that sort of thinking anymore.
It's interesting with the stripping him of the titles because you cannot strip someone of a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, but hasn't he sold his?
He sold the medal.
Okay.
But obviously you cannot. But in the whole stripping people of the Nobel Prize was, you know, the whole issue arose some time ago, several years ago, with Aung San Suu Kyi, who there were calls to have her Nobel Peace Prize stripped after the ongoing genocide in Myanmar. And they said that they cannot do it because, like Watson, something that someone has done that has bettered the human race, the reason they give you the Nobel Prizes, it doesn't get undone by your future actions.
Mm.
The world has still been massively improved because of this discovery that he's made,
yeah.
No matter what his beliefs are nowadays.
Yeah. It just doesn't entitle him to do whatever he wants.
Oh, gosh, no.
Yeah.
I find it really worrying how much sort of, say we've got these big science figures and then if they make these comments, how it now normalises it in a society that I think has moved on from the time when he was a young person.
Mm.
And I just wanted to bring up some news which came out 8 hours ago, and that 2 people were killed and 40
breaking
were detained
news.
In a new gay purge in Chechnya. So that's
yeah.
something which has happened today,
mm-hmm.
and yet we're talking about
yeah.
the
yeah.
big celebrity,
mm-hmm.
big,
yeah.
big science celebrity that has come out and made homophobic comments.
Yeah.
It's not too
yeah.
far away
it
from the modern day.
Yeah. With all these recent headlines about Watson, on Twitter, I've recently noticed a letter that came up, which was a letter sent from Watson to Francis when Watson was writing his book, Double Helix. Yes, it's called Double Helix, and it's one of the most famous or popular science books in biology. And what I find really interesting, so the letter was sent, Watson wanted Francis to comment on the book, on the draft of the book, and what he thinks about it. And here's what Francis wrote about it. Dear Jim, the new version of the Honest Gem, which was the working title for the Double Helix, is naturally a little better, but the basic objections to it remain the same as before. They are: the book is not a history of the discovery of DNA as it claims to be in the preface. Instead, it is a fragment of your autobiography which covers the period when you worked on DNA. Then he lists all sorts of reasons why this is a fragment of his autobiography, and then he goes on to say, it is thus absolutely clear that your book is not a history as normally understood. However, once it is released that it is not a history, but a part of your autobiography, many of the points made above become irrelevant. Unfortunately, you yourself claim it as history, and the misguided but worthy people who are supporting you in publishing it also use this as their major excuse for publication. Should you persist in regarding your book as a history, I should add that it shows such a naive and egotistical view of the subject as to be scarcely credible. Anything which concerns you and your reactions apparently is historically relevant, and anything else is thought not to matter. In particular, the history of the scientific discovery is displayed as a gossip. Anything with any intellectual content, including matters which are of central importance to us at the time, is skipped over and omitted. Your view of a history is that found in the lower class of women's magazines. So this is Francis talking to Watson. That's what he thought of the Double Helix book, which is, it kind of shows me that, you know, he was like this long, long time ago. This is not an accidental sort of his misspoken words, but it's really something that he was probably many years ago.
Yeah, the kind of egotistical nature of many scientists is something that unfortunately is quite prevalent in the scientific community with many kind of PIs, private investigators, in order to kind of reach the kind of pinnacle of mm. scientific research, to have your own lab. Unfortunately, a common characteristic, I'm not going to say the majority of characteristics, but one that comes up again and again, is one of being quite egotistical and narcissistic and possibly even sociopathic.
Mm.
And this impacts the entire scientific community.
I think it's often sadly the case that you need to be a bit of a alpha male to be running a lab, and that's why for women it's so much harder often
yeah.
to get to those positions. And often when a woman gets into that position, it is also because she's a bit tougher than everyone else, which just kind of creates this not really nice environment to be in. But having said that, I know many PIs or principal investigators who are great people, like brilliant
absolutely.
People. This is not
many
not
lovely
to say.
Ones.
but yeah, there's a lot of politics in science, and in politics you have to be a bit of.
It's a dog eat dog world, as one professor once told me.
Dog eat dog world. Anyone else has anything to add? Silence. So then I think we'll go to our next song, Lord, Perfect Places.
Every night I live and die, feel the party to my bones. Watch the wasters blow the speakers, spill my guts beneath the outdoor light. It's just another graceless night. I hate the headlines and the weather. I'm 19 and I'm on fire. But when we're dancing, I'm alright. It's just another graceless night. Are you lost enough? Have another drink, get lost in us. This is how we get notorious. Keep telling me where to go. I put my brains out to the radio. Oh, oh, oh. All of the things we're taking, 'cause we are young and we're ashamed. Send us to perfect places. All of our heroes. Somebody take them home. Let's kiss and then take off our clothes. It's just another graceless night. Find these perfect places. What the fuck are perfect places anyway?
And we are back in our own perfect place, which is Imperial College Science Communication Studio. And it's, what time is it? It's 17:49, and we're talking all about bad science. And now, so science can be done by good people, science can be done by bad people, people can do bad science, but sometimes scientific research ends up inventing things that are not so great for our society. And now Harry will tell us a bit about this historical scientific fight, you could say, which was, I think, officially called Current Wars?
Something like that. It's. I don't think it has an official name as such, but it is known as the Current Wars. And this is, of course, the AC versus DC debate. Now,
can you just say what is AC and what
yes,
is DC?
So AC is alternating current. So this is the type of electricity you'll get from a plug socket where your current literally alternates backwards and forwards. And DC stands for direct current, which is like batteries where all of the electrons flow in one direction around the circuit.
And now I'm going to say something really stupid, but is this from where AC/DC got their name? And that's why their title has a...
I have no idea, but it would not surprise
me. I think I made
me.
A scientific discovery here! Oh my god!
Who's AC/DC?
Oh, okay, well, okay.
Right, we'll get onto this later.
Let's continue!
That was a joke, just to clarify.
So, the current wars took place in the very late 19th century. So, it was the late 1880s to the early 1890s. And this was when Tesla, Edison, Westinghouse and Brown were all kind of developing lots of different engineering electrical items. And on one side of the debate, the AC side, you had Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse, who were both massive proponents of this style of current. And on the opposing side, you had Edison and Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've all heard of Edison. We've all heard of Tesla. Westinghouse and Brown are slightly less well known, but they're actually almost the more important people in this.
The unspoken heroes.
Yeah, I guess you could almost call it, it's like a Cold War style situation where Tesla and Edison were the big powerhouses and Westinghouse and Brown were the ones who did the whole, like, the actual brawl.
Yeah.
Now, in 1888, the Edison Company claimed that AC was dangerous and it was this awful thing which would kill people, it would make them ill, and as part of that they funded Harold Brown and his experiments where he would in public use AC current to kill animals.
Well, that's a shock.
And that led on to something which is a bit more well known, where AC current is used to kill people. The electric chair, which was effectively like the culmination
mm-hmm.
of where this came from, basically to show that look how dangerous this is. It's killing people. DC could never do this.
Mm.
Clearly, we are the better option.
So, but initially, then it wasn't so, it was as a showcase of its danger rather than as its use in prisons, right?
Yes. So, it's very much like, actually, looking at the politics and science and relating it to politics, it's very much like the Hillary Trump campaign. Instead of saying, this is why you should go for my brand, it was a, this is why the other brand will cause you ruin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And unfortunately, sometime after Tesla's death, Edison then came forward and said, oh, looks like I was wrong. Turns out AC is actually more useful in several situations.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it was too late for Tesla to to feel better about that. But it was basically a fear campaign to show that AC is dangerous, and even if it's not affecting people directly, there's this kind of ingrown fear because it's what AC was being used for at the time, was the electric chair, and that kills people. And even if you didn't, if you weren't personally affected by that, it's always there in the back of your mind, kind of niggling away,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing.
I mean, there's more things which are wrong with Edison, because so Tesla invented the light bulb, and he deliberately didn't want to patent it because he thought that it should be for all of humanity to have access to that design and not have to pay for it. So along comes Edison and patents it, and becomes incredibly, incredibly rich off of it, and then Nikola Tesla eventually dies with no money left. He ends up broke.
Yeah, he died of a heart attack in a hotel bath.
Oh, God.
Or at least that was where the body was found.
Yeah.
Make of that what you will. Edison was not a great person, I think, is probably where we can go with this.
He was more a businessman than a scientist.
Yes, very much so.
The time, the two were more interlinked than they are now, I think.
And it very much kind of goes into the vein of when politics gets involved in science...
And when capitalism gets involved in science,
you can end up with some pretty unpleasant results.
Yeah, I think I have another example like this. Anyone heard about Fritz Haber? I think that's how you call it.
Yes, Fritz
Haber. He won a Nobel Prize in when in 1918, oh, during influenza pandemic, in 1918 for Haber-Bosch process, which obviously allows you to synthesize ammonia from nitrogen and hydrogen, which is used to make fertilizers, which essentially fed the growing population in the world, right? It's a huge thing and it's really important, but he's also kind of often called the godfather of chemical warfare because he was the one who sort of allowed use chlorine gas in World War One, and he's also obviously one of the people who worked on Zyklon A, which ended up being the gas used in the gas chambers, mm-hmm. yeah, during World War Two, and ironically is probably not the right word here, but a lot of his family ended up in being killed
so his,
by that.
Yeah, so Haber's family were Jewish.
Yeah.
Or at least a lot of the family were Jewish. And his wife actually committed suicide because she couldn't handle the knowledge of what her husband had done. Because he is actually, yeah, he's remembered as the Haber process man. He's not remembered for the millions and millions of deaths that came from all of his that came from his inventions.
Yeah. Listen to a Radiolab episode on it. It's a brilliant one. Well, I think we have given people a lot of ideas and topics to talk about. What is bad science? So, Jacqueline, once again, can you just tell us how people can send their ideas if they would like to write for iScience? And do you have any other topics for them to choose from?
Yes. So we've just sent out our pitch list. It's got a long range of topics we're reaching. If anyone wants to contribute any writing or any illustrations, you can send them to i.science@imperial.ac.uk. And what we've been, or what we're hoping to hear back from people on, is just a couple of topics that we think that someone out there is probably the best person to kind of get under the skin of all these issues. We are touching on, you know, the myth of the female orgasm in science. That should be a hot topic for whoever. I've covered that myself in the past, and my parents have told me to stay away from it. So I've had my fill. But really, you know, we want to cover issues from, you know, any of the Nazi science experiments that took place in the 30s and 40s. What do we do if any of the empirical data is, you know, sound science? Yeah. Is it ethical to use it? Is it ethical to make a film about the environment and conservationism when you're jetting private planes? And, you know, if you're looking at the carbon footprint of the average documentary, it's astronomical. But, you know, is it a means to an end? And there's just so many issues, the science of transition center surgery and gender realignment. You know, as the world expands, I think scientific conversations should kind of go with it. And we're just hoping to get into the nitty-gritty stuff and just make it a really interesting read for the next issue.
I'm sure it will be a fascinating thing. I'm myself, as a researcher, I sort of always think as a scientist as a good thing for society, and I do think that science itself as such is, but reality is that science is a social construct, and there are people involved in it, and people just like everyone else, they just like in other kinds of people, artists or politicians, we all bring something to our work, and that's why you get these conflicts, you get bad ideas, you get selfish people, you get people who require attention, and it all sort of messes up the real beauty of science that does make world a better place. But we have to talk about it, and the only way to solve these problems is by really talking about it. So really, I hope that people enjoyed this this edition of iScience Radio, and you can tune in next time, next week, same time, same place, at 5 o'clock on Monday evening. And thank you everyone for listening, and thank you to our contributors. Bye bye.